Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
Reseeding. And no, this isn't a garden show talking about whether you should reseed your lawn this time of year to try to become a little more lush as the spring season goes along. But reseeding the Final Four.
Oh, I thought it was Stephen A. Smith's hairline reseeding. Oh. No, it wasn't that? No,
okay. It could be that.
That's also an option.
You one time will enjoy the factors of reseeding, you and Fish, right now.
Nah, never, right? We're keeping this hair forever.
I don't know what Bob's talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's what I thought when I was your age. But no, reseeding. The Final Four right now this year, you've got the left side of the bracket, which is the upset side of the bracket. The right side of the bracket is the blue bloods that have made it through, teams that have done it all year long. If the idea is to get the best two teams in the championship game and have the best game possible, reseeding is something that should happen.
That's not the idea of March Madness, though. And I've typically understood the argument for reseeding the teams at the Final Four. And this, probably more than a lot of years, it's just so obvious. Like, you have, you know, 2-1 seeds on one side and a 3 and an 11. Like, how often do you get an 11 anyway? So that kind of throws things off. But, like, almost the feel of March Madness, and the more I think about it, it's not ideal. The whole thing about it is not ideal. Like, the best teams don't advance. That's kind of celebrated with the tournament. Paths for teams are different. Some teams get easy ones. Some teams don't. You know, the path for Villanova to get here, they basically had to play a team right there that they were supposed to via seed line for a number one seed. You know, Kansas is pretty close to that, too, having to play teams that were pretty much what was expected for them. Michigan hasn't. Loyola Chicago hasn't. And that's kind of the beauty of the tournament in a way. And when you get to the Final Four, why exactly should you adjust the rules? Maybe you should keep them the way they are.
I thought coming into this exercise, and I say exercise because I went through the entire list of Final Fours since the seeded era began in the late 70s. And I'm thinking that I'm going to build a case, that I'm going to come in here and I'm going to argue with Chris. And I'm going to say that reseeding should be something that happens because I thought that it would be a big deal more years than not. I can go back to one year that looks like this year where you have two upset teams on one side of the bracket and two big-time favorites on the other side of the bracket. Really only one time that I would have thinking that it would make a big difference, and that was in 96. And that was the year that Kentucky and UMass were both number one seeds. They were on one side of the bracket. UMass came in with one loss to the start of the tournament. Kentucky came in with two losses. The other side of the bracket had Mississippi State as a 5 make it through and Syracuse as a 4 make it through. The semifinal game between UMass and Kentucky seemed like the national championship. And it ended up really being the national championship because Kentucky ended up taking Syracuse down by 9 in the championship game two nights later. Every other time, it really didn't seem to matter much. And in a couple of times, if it had happened, Chris, we would have been cheated out of some of the more memorable games in championship history. Kansas-Oklahoma won, where you had Oklahoma that was the favorite all season long with Mookie Blaylock and Stacey King getting beat by Danny Manning and the Miracles out of the same conference. If you reseed, you lose that championship game. Also, the Keith Smart winning shot for Indiana over Syracuse would have been another one that you would have lost by reseeding. And maybe the biggest two of all to lose by reseeding, you would have lost Villanova-Georgetown and North Carolina State-Houston if you would have reseeded the semifinals to the finals. Now, maybe you would have ended up with some other game that would have been great, but it might have been a game that involved two big-time favorites against one another, and then it wouldn't have been as special as Villanova beating Georgetown, playing the perfect basketball game, or NC State coming up with maybe the most incredible upset in finals history over Phi Slamma Jamma in Houston.
Yeah, and to your point, I feel like it comes down to what you think about Loyola Chicago, right? Like, there's some people who are yelling and screaming on TV saying, like, I don't want to see Loyola Chicago keep winning because you're eliminating the best teams from playing by watching Loyola Chicago beat those better teams, so you're kind of ruining the Titanic matchups. Are you can take the other side of you love the Sister Jean story and this team out of Chicago nobody really talked about from a basketball standpoint since they had their run in the past in the 80s. So whether you think it's good or bad determines whether you think reseeding would be good or bad. And on the same note of kind of what you mentioned about, you know, sometimes you've had the two best teams playing each other in the Final Four. A lot of those years, the championship game was also really good. So in a way, you're getting two championship games with the way it's currently set up, right? Because you can make the case that this year on the Villanova-Kansas game, that's going to feel like a championship game because you have two really good teams squaring off, and it's going to be, you know, 2-1 seeds. Whoever loses, you're going to feel like they just blew a chance at a championship. They lost a championship. Whoever wins, you're going to feel like they have won the championship even though they haven't locked it up yet. And the lower seeds have performed pretty well once they've gotten to that championship. So not only will the Final Four matchup between the 2-1 seeds feel like a championship game, if the lower seeds continue to play in the way like they have, Loyola Chicago versus whoever they would face, if you know Loyola Chicago does win and upset Michigan, that would probably feel like a title game. And maybe I'm just skewed from the last 8 years. Because every championship game within the last 8 years has been close. It's been one where you don't know the result of it come halftime, back and forth. Last year's game was really close. The game-winning shot was the year before by Villanova over North Carolina. Within that stretch, was it Bill Self? His Kansas team went on a game against Memphis and Coach Calipari, and that was one that went into overtime. It's almost regardless of the matchup. I think the worst championship game we've had over that stretch is Connecticut over Butler in 2011, where Butler just really was outclassed. But that was just mainly because Butler was so bad in that game and their style of play. I feel like no matter what the two teams are, the odds are you're probably going to get a pretty good game.
Which matchup, if you could make the matchups move in any direction, we're looking for most interest nationally, most eyeballs interested in the championship game. You think it's Villanova Kansas?
Yeah.
You think would be the most they would get the highest rating if Villanova were to play Kansas on Monday night? You think it would be a higher rating than one of those two overcats taking on the ultimate underdog in Loyola? I think Michigan is the odd team out here. I think Michigan against either Villanova or Kansas draws the lower rating.
Yeah.
If I'm TBS, I'm rooting for Loyola to beat Michigan.
Fair. Well, I mean, you can't have Kansas and
no, but I'm saying if you did, do you think the two number ones, two teams that should be there based on what their regular season body of work has meant, blue bloods in the sport, do you think a Villanova Kansas national championship would get a higher rating than a Loyola against one or the other?
I think it'd be close. Villanova is interesting just because they're a blue blood, but they're also a really small school that I don't really know. I'm from the Philadelphia area, and like Philadelphia isn't exactly united when it comes to Villanova. So they're an interesting blue blood. Like if it was Duke, I'd absolutely say Duke. If it was North Carolina, I'd absolutely say North Carolina. But like Villanova is one of those strange ones where Loyola Chicago and Villanova in a way could have the same kind
of. You're talking about two small Catholic schools, basically. Villanova has had more money and has had more success over the last 20 years in basketball.
I'm skewed. I just don't know how the nation views Villanova. I think that's my problem.
Okay, how does the nation view Kansas? Kansas is a team that's been there, but they're not from a big market. They're from the middle of the country. I know there's a lot of people out there that like Kansas, but I don't think Kansas is viewed nationally as the same as Duke, North Carolina.
I think it is. I think Kansas is a basketball tradition. It's a powerhouse. As casual fans, you know, you don't even have to be from Kansas to like Kansas. I think they're enough of a national brand.
So Kansas would be the biggest name you could get. So Kansas Loyola would give you the biggest bang for your buck.
I think
for the championship game.
Although Michigan fans are all over the place, and they have a lot of support. So Loyola Chicago, though, just the story of it and the fact that an 11 seed, it's almost like watching a documentary play out in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because you know Loyola Chicago is getting, you know, the 30 for 30 treatment, if you will. So it's watching a documentary play out, and that storyline is just too appealing. And I think that storyline might, you know, that's why I say Villanova, typically I would say a blue blood in that spot, yields the most eyeballs for a championship game, a one versus one. But even that storyline with Villanova not being, you know, the biggest school and with the largest support, I think that storyline can match.
I'll give you a storyline to watch Monday night if it's Loyola and Villanova. Most people, although I would say NC State, most people would say Villanova's win over Georgetown is the most improbable championship win in college basketball history. My opinion, if Loyola, from where they're coming from what league they're in, if they go in and knock Villanova off, they take Rolly Massimino's spot away from him.
That's a good one. Jimmy, is Jamel Vano, is his run against Houston, is that
I think in the discussion? I think because they weren't a team that was supposed to get into the tournament, where Villanova was in. Villanova had done pretty well, even though they lost twice to Georgetown previously. My opinion, NC State is a bigger upset over Houston than Villanova over Georgetown, although I think Villanova played the perfect game in beating Georgetown. I think if Loyola beats Villanova or Kansas in the final, I think this will be the biggest upset in college championship history.
And that's a great story.
The fact that they got there from where they were.
And let's make it possible. And if you reseed it, it makes it a lot more unlikely for it to happen. So, like, to wrap the discussion and kind of take it from where we began, I just think there's too many reasons to keep it the way it is. And it's funny because I was on the reseeding argument on that side up until I actually sat down and thought about it when we were going to do this segment. And the more I thought about it, the less I liked it.
100% agree. I was, until I started plotting it and seeing which ones you'd lose, which one you wouldn't. And Chris, I think you made the best point of all. The whole tournament is random. So why don't you keep it random for the last day? It's kind of like changing the rules, you know, in overtime.
Yeah.
You know, making, you know, college football, changing the rules in overtime. It's kind of akin to that if you reseed. So I went from saying yes reseed to no reseed in a matter of 24 hours. $1,000. That's like 100 six-packs. Your shot at $1,000 four times every weekday, 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., 4 p.m., and all you have to do is text the keyword to win. Remember, please don't text while you're driving. 4K a day will start Thursday morning at 7 a.m. on Sports Radio The Ticket. Up next, we're talking college basketball. Mountain West had a team make it to the Sweet 16, almost to the Elite Eight. Two teams made the NCAA tournament. Was it a successful year for the conference? We'll discuss that next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Discussing college basketball, reseed the tournament or not, we have a tweet in from Peter Erlinson. Tweets us, I'd be okay with reseeding for the Sweet 16, but I'd be more interested in reseeding during the conference tournaments. Now, I'm going to say something about this. I like his idea of reseeding the conference tournament, but I think they need to do one thing to tweak the tournament. We'll use the Mountain West as an example. When they play the four games in the quarterfinals, they play the two teams in the daytime, or the two games in the daytime, and have those two teams play on pretty good rest to 6 o'clock at night. Then the teams that play at night play the late game, and they play two other teams that played at night. I think it would be unfair to reseed where somebody that played at noon would play somebody that played at 9:30, turning around the next day. I would tweak the tournament format and to go men's, women's every other day, where you play the women's tournament first round, second round you play the men's, the second day you play the men's. Now, it wouldn't work practically because fans wouldn't want to sit around for certain teams because it would stretch everything out a little bit longer. But I think it would be a way that would make it fairer than if you're Nevada, you play the worst team that's left as the tournament moves along. I think that would be great, but I don't know that it's practical schedule-wise.
Yeah, you can't have that work because there could be a team that plays at 9:30 at night that have to turn around and play at noon the next morning. Like I guess the afternoon. You can't do that. Like, that's just unrealistic.
But if you had a day in between, you could theoretically do that.
Absolutely. A day in between, it's fair. Although, you could say, like, AAU basketball, I mean, these guys have done it, but, like, this isn't AAU when you're talking about conference tournaments and the money that's at stake for making the NCAA tournament and all that. So, yeah, I don't know why you would receive the Sweet 16, though. Like, why? that. Like, I feel like that's changing the bracket too much.
You would change the bracket a lot. Although the one thing that I didn't like about going to the games in Boise, and I could substitute San Diego, Wichita, any of the first round sites. I used to love watching the two games on, say, Saturday. And then in my mind going out, matching those two teams up for the next games on Thursday. But now you had the winner of Kentucky, they won, and Gonzaga won. But they weren't going to play each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think you kind of lose a little of the feel of a tournament when you kind of split it into pods like that. I liked it better when you got to see the teams feed through.
They had an East region and then a West region. So like when you see them through, they're not going to be in the same spot. But I guess this way helps
the gate,
helps
I think.
The gate, right? Because you can have more local, you know, fans if you're closer, the, you know, mm-hmm. one or two seats close to their spot. So you can get more people around. So I understand why they do it. I don't think I've watched the tournament when they had the old way. Like, when did they switch to this?
Like, it was like about 2002, something yeah. like that.
So, I mean, that would make sense where I don't remember the old way as much. So it's not like I can reminisce on. I remember when I used to watch the tournament and I could.
I mean, I'd go into the tournament in person. And as I say, I loved looking at the two teams that you knew were going to play the next week and say, this team did this better, that team did that better.
Coaches might like that, too.
You scouted them live.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the next question on the table as we're wrapping up, and by the way, Coach Rice is going to be in today at 3 o'clock with Caves and Prater. I don't know whether they will ask this question to him or not, but our question on the table is, was this a successful year for the Mountain West? I guess we'll start off. You had a team that made it to the Sweet 16, mm-hmm. very close to making an Elite Eight, and who knows, with the way this year has gone, you'd have knocked off Loyola. Maybe you'd be the team dancing to the Final Four. You also got two teams in, so there's two teams that brought units money to the Mountain West. But I think I'd have to say no, that it really wasn't a successful season because you only got that second team because your conference champ did not win the tournament.
You were a fake multi-bid league.
Absolutely.
You weren't really a multi-bid league. You're a fake one because your runaway champ got upset in the conference tournament. Therefore, you got your second team in.
Hey, it was a great move from the league's perspective.
Nevada
to lose. The refs should be instructed to blow the whistle and don't allow your regular season champ to win the conference tournament when it's about getting another team in the tournament.
Because Nevada was slam dunk in. And then San Diego State was a bid stealer. And who was the last team, the first team out of the...
Was it St. Mary's?
Yeah, St. Mary's might have been. So it's unfortunate. Stealing from the West Coast
Conference. No, it was Notre Dame. It was Notre Dame.
But St. Mary's was right on that
line. They were right on the list.
Which, in a way, is that going to be the difference between Gonzaga leaving the West Coast Conference and Gonzaga staying in the West Coast Conference? Is the fact that San Diego State stole a bid that theory could have gone to St. Mary's. Which is why I think the answer to this question is incomplete, because if somehow, some way in the next month, Gonzaga's in the Mountain West for basketball, well, then it was absolutely a successful year for basketball in the Mountain West because it was enough to get Gonzaga into this league. And you'd have to say that's a victory if you get a program that is right now a powerhouse to join your conference and add to the depth of the league. So it was a fake multi-bid league. And in a way, like, if you're just looking at it objectively, hasn't the West Coast Conference, because they've had two teams at the top who have been really good, like in theory, they have been more successful in the NCAA tournament, getting teams into the NCAA tournament than the Mountain West, because the Mountain West had been for a couple of years there, a one-bid league, while the West Coast Conference is out here getting a couple of teams, and St. Mary's was a threat to win some games. I don't know if they ever did make it past the round of 32. Gonzaga, of course, made a run to the national championship game last year. So if the Mountain West isn't more successful than the West Coast Conference, I don't know how you could say that it's like successful as in teams in the NCAA tournament. They, of course, have a deeper league and the NIT teams and RPI in the middle of the pack and conference RPI. That's all significantly better than the West Coast Conference. But we, as college basketball fans, how we judge a strength of a conference is usually how many teams you get in the tournament and how those teams do once they get there.
Talking about whether this was a successful year for the Mountain West, there was a few years ago, I believe it was 13, where five teams got into the tournament. And I think that, to me, is where the Mountain West is superior to the WCC. The WCC is doing the same two teams every year, and nobody else is contributing. When you look over the years at the teams that have made the NCAA tournament out of the Mountain West body of teams, the randomness is much more there as far as different teams getting in, where there's only two that have done it in the WCC. I, though, come off this season more encouraged than less encouraged for the Mountain West. As Chris mentioned, Gonzaga, if they're able to pull it off, that's a home run. You've got a defending champ in Nevada that got to the Sweet 16, could have gone further, that's going to basically return their team. Kendall Stevens is the only senior on that team that plays. And I'm thinking that the Martins aren't going to go pro. They may test the waters, but I think they'll come back. So I think you're going to see a really good team in Nevada returning. Towards the end of the conference season, San Diego State and New Mexico both took tremendous strides. I think those two teams need to be amongst the elite teams in the league for this team to be good. And then I think the 800-pound gorilla is UNLV. If UNLV could ever get its act together, that's a team that people are interested in nationally, going back to the Tarkanian year. They need to be good. And then you've got teams like Boise State that's been good the last few years, Wyoming, Colorado State, Utah State, Fresno State are all going to be doing reboots with new basketball coaches. I think there are only two schools in the league out of 11 now, 12 if you count Gonzaga, that will bring nothing to the table for basketball, and that being Air Force and San Jose State. But I think under the right situations with the right coaches, all the other 10 could be competitive and chase possible NCAA bids.
Yeah, that's fair. And a lot of it has to do with, and you've heard, you know, Commissioner Thompson kind of mentioned scheduling and, like, got to make sure that these teams go out and play people so you can just help the overall league. Because I just feel like, given the dynamics of this conference, and I made this argument a few times during the league, I don't know how often you're going to have multiple teams do what Nevada did and just, like, put themselves in a position where they're significantly better. And they have such a great conference here that they're, like, a bona fide team. Because this league has so many tough travel spots. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you got to go to Laramie. You got to go to the Pit. You know, Boise's not an easy place to play for a lot of other teams.
San Diego's,
like, I don't know if necessarily.
Travel, but the spot.
Yeah, the spot is, it's a nice spot to go to, but it sometimes is a tough place to play. But just like the natural factors about this league where you have some really high elevation places, like, you know, Colorado Springs, stuff to get to Laramie, Wyoming, that I just think that wears on you, and it's hard to get through this league unscathed. So you have to make it so those losses that you suffer along the way aren't crippling losses. And not every team can have the excellent non-conference that Nevada did, but at least they tried. And wasn't it also rumored that they, you know, tried to get more games, like St. Mary's canceled a game against them that they wanted to get? So, like, they went out and tried, and that's kind of what you have to do in this league, because I don't think it's possible for a lot of teams to go through this with three losses, two losses, because the travel is too difficult. So if you know that kind of going in, the way you offset that is you have to have enough built up before you get to the league play to where you can withstand it. I guess it's encouraging that San Diego State and New Mexico took steps by the end of the year. I'm wondering how sustainable that is. Like, I still wasn't as impressed with New Mexico when they came here because they looked awful. I don't know what their talent
says. Same thing about Loyola.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know what, like, again, even when they played in the championship game against San Diego State, and I saw that in person, I didn't come away looking at that roster and say, oh, my goodness, this is a, like, they're beating people on talent. Like, maybe they were well coached by the end of it.
They're well coached. It just, they, to me, look like a team. As the season went along, they got better and better.
Yeah.
And I think with the tradition they have, the money and support they have for basketball at New Mexico, they certainly should be a top half of the league team.
Indeed, and they were. And still, Mountain West, we still don't think they had a, you know, bona fide successful year.
No. And let me pose this next question to you. I'm looking at Gonzaga year by year. Gonzaga has not lost four conference games since 1998. The league winner in this conference averages around four conference losses a year. The league winner.
Mm-hmm.
Gonzaga was 10-4, only had 14 conference games in 97-98, assuming they stay with 18 conference games. You think Gonzaga, their record's going to take a hit by at least two or three. If they're averaging anywhere from one to maybe three conference losses over the last 20 years, their record is going to be skewed a little bit weaker.
Mm-hmm.
But they must think, if they're considering this strongly, and this is indeed something they're considering, they have to think that they'll be either better primed for the tournament or that their RPI is going to go up and they're going to get better seats.
Yeah, and it's still somewhat confusing as to why it is. Like, everybody is saying it's more likely than not. I've heard a lot of people say that, and I'm still waiting to see it before I believe it. But I think regardless, it's a big boost for the Mountain West, and we're approaching this discussion from the Mountain West point of view. And if you're able to get Gonzaga in the league, like, then it's no doubt a successful year of basketball in the conference.
It's Final Four Saturday coming up on Sports Radio The Ticket. The incredible Loyola Chicago story will continue at 4 p.m. as the Ramblers take on Michigan. It'll come to you from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, and it's followed by Kansas and Villanova. Final Four on Sports Radio The Ticket. National championship game will be on Monday at 7:20. If you can't watch it, be sure to listen right here on The Ticket. Coming up next in the update, what Mountain West player was named honorable mention All-American? That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update sponsored by Wendy's. Wendy's serves fresh beef on every hamburger every day. Download the Wendy's app for offers you can't find anywhere else. Well, the AP announced their All-American team for college basketball today, and the Mountain West got one honorable mention. That went to Mountain West Player of the Year Caleb Barton, who's second in the Mountain West at scoring at 19.1 points per game. And as Bob mentioned earlier, both him and his twin brother Cody will have 1 year of eligibility left should they choose to return to Nevada, who's coming off a Sweet 16 appearance.
I think when you look at Martin, he was a player of the year in the league. I think that always obviously carries weight when you're looking at it from AP. And then he goes on to, you know, have some good games in the tournament. So congratulations to him. Thought maybe Chandler would have had a shot to find himself as an honorable mention. Not exactly sure what you need to do. Different groups. I know certain leagues that I've voted in before, sometimes you get on the ballot, you're an honorable mention. Sometimes if you get a certain number of votes, you're an honorable mention. But again, congratulations to Caleb Martin.
And I will say this, that, like, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot and Chandler, or if Caleb Martin was voted the player of the year and then Chandler Hutchison had a postseason like Caleb Martin did, we would be all up in everybody's face talking about how Chandler Hutchison was really the best player and deserved it and all that stuff. And I mean, you sometimes just got to, like, shake your hand. I know Chandler Hutchison Media was voted the player of the year, and Caleb Martin is the one who ended up dominating the postseason. And you guys got to say, hey, great job by Caleb Martin in doing what, you know, we hoped that Chandler Hutchison was going to do with Boise State.
I think from the league, we were talking about whether it's a successful year for the league. I think we need to have more Caleb Martin and Chandler Hutchisons across the league where we're arguing over who the best player in the league is. Because that means if you've got three or four of them, you probably got three or four better teams than you had this year.
Talking about good postseasons, Chris, unofficially, like if you go to ESPN, you search by stats, points per game, Chandler Hutchison leads postseason points per game.
Oh, yeah. Well, he did.
Every time I
NIT.
Go to the stats, he's number one because he had 39 in one game. So
that's fair. He balled in the NIT game. And they kept Boise State in it for as long as they could have been in it.
So he technically is the postseason points per game leader in the NCAA if you want to go by ESPN. So,
well, I think Chandler will see scoring games and important games in the NBA in the future.
Yes. Well, the NFL currently working on its schedule, and some fans might be looking for a scapegoat for when their team has to go on the road, especially in Week 1. And if you're a Detroit Lions fan, you can point that blame at Ed Sheeran. That's because Chris Burke of The Athletic on Twitter noted that Ed Sheeran's concerts have created conflicts with nine teams' home dates for the NFL, and meaning the Lions will start on the road Week 1 because they are hosting a Ed Sheeran concert at Ford Field.
Well, I would say this for the Lions, and I don't know who owns and runs Ford Field, but don't schedule a concert over a weekend when you might want to open the season. I would think that these clubs have much greater control of the dates, and they were greedy and they had a chance to book Ed Sheeran and figure, you know what, let's book Ed Sheeran and then we'll play at home another week.
Also came out today that in Detroit they couldn't host the draft because there's a robotics convention going on.
The robotics convention, though, is much more interesting than a draft. The draft, they just read names. The robotics convention, you can see stuff like 10 years in the future. Like, I'm all about the robotics conventions.
But you think about it. How many years out was the robotics convention booked? Probably more than the NFL draft that's looking ahead. So you've got to get in there, and if not, do what sometimes the Big Ten did. Move your weekend.
What's the convention that's causing the Mountain West to have their...
It's like some construction convention that they're moving it not next year, but the following year a week early. And they opted because you remember what we paid for hotel.
I didn't pay, by the
way. You didn't, but
so just for the record, I don't got that kind of money to be paying all that for
no,
hotels.
But,
in
but
Vegas
the hotels were double.
Yeah.
Were double to triple what they were this year. I think if you're going to keep it in Vegas, I know a lot of people that either were very disappointed that when they looked into what the cost of the hotel was, or a couple people that bought their plane ticket and then looked for hotels and then realized, wow, this is what I got
to
pay.
But rank the conventions that you would, or rank the events that you would rather go to. Robotics convention, the construction convention, or the NFL draft?
Like to sit there and watch the whole thing?
Yeah.
The construction convention.
You could like take in, like, I don't know how people take in conventions. Like, you know, you can go to some of the things. You can just hang out and talk to people. Like, that's kind of what a convention is.
Right? I guess. I don't know. I've never been to something like Comic-Con or something. I know Comic-Con's the one that if you really want to have a lot of people come to it, that's the one you want.
Or the South by Southwest these days. That's become huge. That was just recently, too. So, come on. You got to answer the question.
What do they do with robotics? Am I going to watch robots fight each other?
I don't know. It's just, you got the three. They're listed out there.
I would go to the NFL one just figuring I could rub shoulders with people because I don't know what I'm getting at the other one. I at least know what I'm getting at the NFL draft. But I promise you that I will slip out as names are being called to go do something else or have something to eat or drink, and then I'll just get the names when I come back.
I think I pick robotics number one. I don't know about you, Fish, but like,
if there was robots fighting, I'd pick robotics.
I would too, but you didn't tell me
that. I don't know what it is, but like, that's the kind of the mystery is you don't know what's going to be. If you knew exactly what would be at the robotics convention, it would almost be less interesting.
It'd be a coin. I mean, I guess I'd put robotics number one, but just barely. Because after day one of the NFL draft, I don't care. I'm sorry. I don't care who the Saints' seventh round pick is.
Will later the next year. But,
yeah. Well, speaking of Vegas, we never got to figure this out. Bob, did you get upgraded this year in your hotel suite? Every year, Bob gets upgraded, and we didn't hear about it this year.
I didn't get upgraded.
Oh. All right, that's all I need to know. We can continue on with the update now. I just need to know if Bob got upgraded. Well, you know,
no, I had to think for a second because I have gotten upgraded.
Yeah, every year.
Times.
I feel like Bob always says, "Well, I got upgraded."
But it's usually at the Mountain West Media Day.
I just know every time Bob goes to Vegas, he gets upgraded, and Chris doesn't. So I just had to make sure.
Well, the best one was when Cades rushed in ahead of me at Mountain West Media Day so he could get to the counter first so he could go eat, drink, or do whatever, and he got the last regular room. I thought that was the best time ever.
Was that the same year you guys were supposed to be hosting Mountain West Media Days and y'all were on the air munching
eating?
On brownies and stuff? And y'all coming back smacking your lips because y'all can't even finish chewing all the food you're eating before y'all need to go on air? Come on, be professional.
Food was good.
Oh, well, in the sports update, a couple of dominoes have fallen in the college basketball coaching market. The University of Pittsburgh has named their new head coach, Duke assistant Jeff Capel. He's been named the head coach of Pittsburgh coming off a winless year in the ACC. And then it was reported today by Jeff Goodman of ESPN about 40 minutes ago that Chris Mack, the former head coach of Xavier, has taken a 7-year deal at Louisville that will pay him $4 million a year.
So now that means that Xavier is the best job that is open right now. I thought that if Mike Hopkins, the former Syracuse assistant, his name was mentioned at Pitt, that if he had done it, that would have opened up some dominoes in the West. But right now, not a whole lot out here open. Fresno State, probably the best job that's still out there on the western side of the country that's open.
And West Coast basketball is in such a good state right now, it's no surprise that all the jobs right now are safe and secure because all that domination by the Pac-12 and the NCAA tournament and all the great success from all these West Coast teams. Wait a minute.
I'm trying to say, the Pac-12 had what I thought was a terrible year. I don't think there's a coaching change in the Pac-12 right now, is there?
They were a lot last year, though, right?
They did.
A couple. So, like, they're still in the growing process of, you know, some of the coaches who just took over. But, you know, for a conference that was so bad, being this stable is interesting.
Gonzaga comes in. Not far-fetched to say the Mountain West can be the best Western Conference in college basketball.
Yeah, I mean, was the Mountain West better than the Pac-12 this year?
They at least won a tournament game.
Nevada was better than Arizona, pretty much. Yeah. If Arizona is what's carrying the Pac-12, Nevada, to me, was just about as good as Arizona. Arizona wasn't even great in the non-conference. They just got really highly ranked because they beat up on Pac-12 teams when they were in the league. They had a terrible start to the year.
Nevada was the best team, I think, in the end of the two conferences. $1,000. That's like excuse me, 100 six packs. Your shot, a shot at $1,000 four times every weekday, 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. All you have to do is text the keyword to win. Remember, please don't text while you're driving. 4K a day will start on Thursday at 7 a.m. That's on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Coming up next in Quick Hits, yesterday we talked about the great accomplishment of the Sixers making the playoffs. Today, even Chris will have to agree that their deeds pale in comparison to what is happening in the NHL this season. That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris. Topic number one.
All right, Chris, what was the feel-good game of the year in the NBA? I think you mean something that just happened, not one that's to come.
Yeah, it happened last night out of the blue. It just kind of shows you never know what's going to happen when you wake up each day. Markelle Fultz played yesterday. He played basketball for the Sixers, the number one pick in the draft, who had missed not one, not two, not three, but 68 games after playing in the first four. He clearly wasn't right. His shoulder is messed up, and it caused him to have to basically relearn his shooting form. He had to relearn how to shoot, and he was finally able to take the court. It was kind of in his decision as to whether he was ready, and of course there's, you know, a whole confidence aspect to, okay, when you're learning how to shoot, it's like kind of learning how to throw a ball or learning how to walk. You kind of have to get up to a level where you feel like you can do it on an NBA court. And after 68 games, yeah, he's only 19 years old and number one pick in the draft. Certainly the expectations go along with it. A year that clearly is from a year from hell for Markelle Fultz, and he finally was able to play basketball. He scored 10 points at 8 assists in 14 minutes, so he's going to play pretty well. You know, he felt rushed, too. He's made some mistakes that would certainly come from a guy who hasn't played in, you know, 68 games. But it was just, you know, fun to see him play basketball, and the Philly crowd was excellent with this, too. I know Philly fans, from the national perspective, they're always bitter, and they're always booing, and they're so, you know, negative as a fan base. They were absolutely positive here. They were cheering it when he stepped on the court for warm-ups, cheered when he came onto the court for the first time and he got the ball for the first time. By the way, Philly fans, have you know that skull chant that the Vikings had? They don't no longer have that because Philadelphia stole it when they won the NFC Championship game against the Vikings. Instead of the skull chant, they do Foles and do the claps. And now they did it with Fultz when he came back in at the end. He had two jumpers, too. So there was just Brett Brown, who's the head coach of the Sixers. He was clearly very emotional when he made the surprise announcement about 90 minutes before the game that, I'm going to tell you something about Markelle Fultz. We're going to play him today. It kind of was shocking because, you know, we almost accepted the fact that he wasn't going to play at all this season. So I just feel happy for him. I feel happy for the teammates who clearly were happy for him. They had a bunch of smiles. They were dumping water on his head and everything like that. And, you know, happy for the fans because they show themselves out pretty well.
As somebody that doesn't have a team that he roots for in the NBA, that just looks at things maybe a little more objectively and, you know, looking back at the big picture, I think this is huge for the Sixers. You've got guys like Steph Curry right now that are hurt and out. You've got other guys that have to be kind of beat up as the season's gone along. You're adding somebody into your rotation at this time, basically to play for a couple of weeks before the regular season ends to sharpen themselves up for the playoffs. I think this is a big win for the Sixers.
Topic number two.
I hope he can play at a playoff level. I mean, he's still 19 years old, and he's played in a grand total of five NBA games. So to think that he is playoff ready, I guess we'll see in these last nine games. But we congratulated the Sixers. Mainly I did. By the way, I need to say trust the process. I didn't even say trust the process during that answer, but Fultz definitely did. But the Sixers made the playoffs, but who else needs to be recognized for an even more improbable feat of making the playoffs?
Vegas Golden Knights. Looks like they may even win their division. But to show you how rare expansion teams are, and they usually give you a pile of nothing, the beans that Jack was given would be worth more than the players they usually give you in the expansion list, although they made it a little more favorable. But they've made the playoffs. They're probably going to win the division. Going over some things. Never happened in expansion era of baseball, which would have started in 1961. Never happened to an expansion team in football. And I'm not going to count the NHL in 67-68 when they had the original six, expanded to six teams, put all six teams that were new in a division, and then had the old division and the new division each come through and represent each other in the conference championship. There has never been an expansion team that's won a playoff game in their first year. Only the Chicago Bulls have qualified as an expansion team for the playoffs. That was back in 1967. But I'm using the word qualified in quotes. Their record was 33-48. What the Vegas Golden Knights, to me, are doing in a first year, nothing compares to what they've done in their first year versus any other team.
Fantastic. Great for them. It's awesome, and especially if it's an expansion team in the NHL to do what they're doing. And Vegas really loves them. That home crowd is fantastic. It comes across well on TV and the highlights. But nobody was out here making fun of the Golden Knights the way they were making fun of the Sixers. And nobody was out here calling them a laughing stock in the way that they were in defending the process, as you know, a lot of people were in my corner with that. So while it's a great feat, I don't know if it necessarily proven the haters wrong like the way the Sixers did.
I told you there was a team that won the whole thing in their league, third year in existence. Who would you guess? What sport? Who would you guess?
I don't know. NFL? Somebody?
No.
Baseball?
No. Although the Marlins were close, they did it in their fifth year. The Bucks did it in their third year of existence. And who did they pick up in their second year?
How about you answer the questions instead of posing it to people who don't know? Answer the question!
Lou Alcindor.
Oh, that
now
always
Kareem
helps.
Abdul-Jabbar. You finished dead last as a rookie team. You get the first pick. By your third year, you win it all.
Topic number three.
All right, Chris, is it smart or dumb for Eagle fans to keep Nick Foles? Or Eagles to keep him, not Eagle fans.
Well, I mean, Eagles fans don't really have much of a say there, right? Eagles fans can want what they want, but I think Howie Roseman, the GM of the Eagles, has more say. I think it's smart for them to keep Nick Foles. They have a quarterback coming off of a torn ACL, and today Doug Peterson says it looks like we're going to keep Nick Foles if you look at the current landscape. And I think it's smart. Carson Wentz coming off of a torn ACL. Foles is their Super Bowl MVP, more than capable as a backup, and that's why you think maybe his trade value is high. But right now his value to your organization is high, because when you have a mobile quarterback that's coming off of a torn ACL in the last month of the year, you're not exactly sure if the rehab process is going to be smooth and he's going to be ready to go week one. You want to have an option with this defending Super Bowl champion to be able to, well, if Carson Wentz isn't ready to go, your season's not torpedoed. So Nick Foles has a lot of value with Philadelphia, and I think it's smart that they're not trading him.
Agreed.
Topic number four.
What is the best and worst story you've heard in a long time?
Well, it was sent to me by one of our listeners, Kevin Warnock, who sends various things, and this one was one that I hadn't seen. It was a story about Nevis Coleman, who was a member of the White Sox ground crew in 1994. He was convicted of rape and murder and served 23 years for a crime that he did not commit. DNA evidence led prosecutors to vacate the charges, and recently, a few months ago, a judge gave him a certificate of innocence. I'd never heard of that before. And he is back with the White Sox this season on the grounds crew. I cannot think of anything worse, Chris, to be accused and convicted of something that you did not do. And for this man to have served 23 years for something he didn't do, to me, that's the worst story I have heard in a long, long time. Glad he's out. Glad the White Sox have him back as an employee.
Agreed. It's a fear that I feel like everybody kind of lives with every day. You hope you're not accused of something that you didn't do.
Mm-hmm. Up next, I'm being made commissioner for a day in baseball. Whatever I say goes. There are going to be a lot of unhappy people in baseball next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
All right, Fish, you know what saying that I've heard probably more over the last 3 weeks than any other saying?
Sister Jean is the greatest cheerleader of all time?
Well, maybe that, but there's this also one, you know, a tradition unlike any other, because, you know, the Masters is coming up. I've watched a lot of the basketball tournament, and Jim Nance and whoever else is calling games, they got to do that Masters promo, and it's always a tradition unlike any other. Well, you know what's a tradition unlike any other on this show? Baseball's coming up. You know what? Opening day, it's odd. Opening day is on a Thursday this week. I'm
in
used
March.
To opening day a Monday in April. Thursday of March? I'm just confused. It's usually like the day of the championship game for college basketball. So that's throwing me off. But opening day will be here before you know it. On Thursday, the season gets started. There's no person more excited for the start of baseball season than Bob Beeler. So with a couple of days left, we're doing a lot of baseball stuff this week. We had to do our tradition unlike any other. And our tradition is
93.1 The Ticket presents Baseball with Bob.
Now coming to the plate, designated hitter, Bob Beeler.
Swings and a fly ball to deep right field. This is going to be a home run. Unbelievable. I don't believe what I just saw.
Yes, it's Baseball with Bob. And the way we're going to frame this is, hey, with the season coming up in a couple of days, a lot more people having their baseball thoughts brought to the table. We've had a lot of off-season discussion on various changes or tweaks. We're just going to go full out and Bob make you the commissioner. The commissioner of baseball is no longer Rob Manfred. Get him out of here. I know he's only had the job for a couple of years, but he's done. His tenure is over. And Bob has taken over the position. And it's not just the commissioner that has some influence. It's the commissioner with all the influence. He don't got to listen to nobody. It's just you.
I've got a list of things here that I want to change in baseball, and I think I'm going to tick off every box. Somebody in every group is going to be mad at me when this is over. But I think it's going to make for a better sport. Let's start with pace of play. Former Commissioner Rob Manfred, as I've taken over from him, mentioned about pace of play being the thing that would be most important about improving in the game of baseball.
I think that pace of play is an issue that we need to be focused on. And the we there are players, owners, umpires, everyone who's invested in this game. And it's going to be an ongoing, I don't think there's a magic bullet that is going to come one year and, you know, that's going to be the solution to pace of play. I think that it's going to be an ongoing effort to make sure that our game moves along in the way that is most attractive to our fans.
All right, so pace of play is going to be the first area that I'm going to attack. First of all, eliminate any hokey ideas. If anybody's sponsoring this minor league and you can fill in the expletive that I would use where you put a runner at second base, they should be immediately fired. They will be immediately fired in my regime. If you want to move the minor league games along and you want to say, call it after nine innings and it's a tie, I'm fine with that. If you want to say that, you know what, minor league's about developing, nobody cares about winning, we're going to play 12 innings, and when the 12 inning comes, much like, you know, 10 innings in a spring training game, we're going to cancel it. So don't change things that affect the game. I don't want to hear runner at second. I don't want to hear pitch clock. I don't want to hear number of pitching changes. All that is out. Now, there are other things that I'm going to bring in. We're going to change in-between inning breaks, which is where I think we're going to get our biggest change in pace of play. We're going to limit it to a minute and 45 seconds between innings. Now we've got the TV executives that are howling. Maybe even the people that sell food at stadiums will be howling. We're going to make it hard and fast. We're going to keep that clock between innings to make sure that it stands at 145. Now, we're going to give the TV people something back on this. There's going to be, you know, you have the crawl with the scroll and the ticker. That's out. It's now going to be a sponsor line that says Budweiser or, you know, whoever the sponsor is for the inning. So they will get that during the course of the inning to allow us to have shorter times between breaks. That's going to take about 15 minutes off a game because most breaks are about 2:45 to 3 minutes between innings prior to this year. So we're saving 15 minutes right there, and we're going to be able to get this thing in under 3 hours. Another way you can speed up the game, we're going to call the rule book strikes. More strikes means the batters are going to have to swing the bat, and pace of play is going to speed up there. I'm also going to add a fifth umpire to the crew. The umpires union is going to love me for this. In addition to home plate, first base, second base, third base, there will be an umpire sitting in the press box. There will be no more New York. You will not go down to the little guy that brings out the headphones where you talk to the guys in New York and ask him about the play. The guy in the press box looking at the monitors, part of that umpiring crew, is going to be the end of discussion guy. So that's going to move it along themselves. Now I want to move on, Chris. You want to come in here with anything as I'm on a roll or not? Go ahead.
do you think I want to disrupt what's going on right now? Absolutely not. You're on a roll. Keep going. There's no place for me to talk right
now. All right. As everybody that's listened to this show in the time I've been on, we're going to eliminate the DH. DH is gone. But we're also, and the players are going to howl at that, saying you're getting rid of one of our veterans that are making big, big money. But we're going to expand the roster to 28, and we're going to limit the number of pitchers that you can have on the team to 13. 13 pitchers, that's it. So it will encourage more pinch running and more pinch hitting, getting a bench into the game, where now with 13 pitchers, there's very little bench used as far as maybe using somebody that can be an exciting pinch runner or pinch hitter in the game of baseball. We're also going to make the game a little more fun. We're going to encourage Latin style of baseball. And the hitters, if you want a bat flip, it's going to be fine. If you're a pitcher and you want to give somebody the six-gun salute for striking somebody out, that's fine. If you turn a double play and you want to give high fives in the middle of the dugout, that's fine. The Latin style of baseball that you see played in those countries makes it a lot of fun for the fans, and I think we need to embrace that. So those are some of the things that I want to do as far as on the game. Now, away from the field, economics. Biggest difference is local TV money. Sorry, Yankees. Sorry, Dodgers. Sorry, Giants. Sorry, big market teams. You're going to lose half of your TV money that you get locally. Gone. Half's going to go to the pot. The pot will be split evenly amongst all the teams under the philosophy that to have a game on TV, you have to have two teams to play the game. So the big market teams are still going to get a bigger cut of the pie because they have their 50% of what they get. But the other 50% is going to be divided evenly amongst all the teams. So the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Giants or whoever will get a percentage, but they'll get the same as the A's, the Pirates, and the Royals of that. So you will even things out. Now, for the lower teams to get money, they're going to have to spend a higher percentage of money on player salaries. So we're going to create a floor, and the floor is going to be significantly higher than what teams are paying. So they're going to have to spend that money that they're getting to make the league a little bit better and more exciting and more competitive. There will be a salary cap at the top as well. So we'll have a both ends, the high end and the low end. We're also going to shorten the season back to the original historical 154. Sorry for season records. But the folks that played prior to 1962, their records for season records were done in 154. That's going to shorten the games. Teams are going to howl because they're going to lose four home dates a year. Maybe everybody's going to have to take 5% less because eight games is 5% of the season. So maybe the players are all going to have to take a 5% reduction in salary. TV people are going to want 5% back off what they're spending. But we're going to give you more on the other end. The wild card is going to be a best of three instead of a best of one. But the wild card, the season's going to end on a Sunday afternoon. The wild card is going to start on Monday, and you're going to play three games in a row, and we're going to move this thing along. There are going to be fewer off days during the postseason as well because we don't want to be playing baseball past Halloween. And lastly, the league needs to do a better job of promoting stars. And I had probably the least amount of ideas in the promoting stars. I was disappointed with myself. Baseball used to have the biggest stars in the sports world. And in the last 15 or so years, they do not. I think that during games, when somebody gets a home run because there's natural stoppages in play, I think they should interview the person so that you have a better idea of who these people are in the game of baseball. So those are just some of my ideas, Chris. We're going to implement them for the 2019 season, and I'm sure I've made every single constituency in baseball mad with something on this list.
I will say you didn't even read everything that you have on your list, and I know we're up against it here.
Oh, there so was one that I did.
Yeah, we're going to get to that, but there's only one response that I could have for what you just did. I mean, you got the crowd chanting. You got the crowd chanting for four more years of Commissioner Bob. Four more years. Four more years. Let's go.
I'll be back with a couple other things that the type was so small that I actually just skipped over. We'll get to them next, and we'll let Chris pick my ideas apart after that when we come back on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Bob and Chris back on Idaho Sports Talk. I think I've caught my breath a little bit after those last 10 minutes, Chris. Didn't give you a chance hardly to say anything.
No, I didn't need to. You got this. You took control of the mic. You are the commissioner of baseball for right now. You can make any change and any suggestion. It's not even a suggestion. It's an implementation that you want to make.
Felt like a president, maybe the commissioner would use it where you kind of skip over something on the teleprompter, and maybe it's my progressive lenses and my glasses, but I missed one of the paragraph notes that I had, so I will go back. This is something that we've talked about in baseball that really I think is a major problem, and I'm being serious when I say this. The players who are the best players in the game a lot of times are in their first 5 or 6 years of playing, and they don't get money until they get to free agency, which is in year six. So I think that that is something that they need to do, and it kind of came to a head this year when owners backed off on giving veterans long-term contracts, big money maybe that would last well past their prime would be over. So here's what I would do with contracts. Players can be restricted free agents after 3 years. That means you can shop yourself around, but your current team has a chance to match, as there needs to be the money that goes to the players in their prime. I also, to give the owners something back, no contracts can be longer than 3 years.
No, any contracts?
Correct.
Wow. Longer than 3 years.
3 years.
That's a drastic shift from the 10-year contracts that we've seen. None longer than 3 years. That'd be the shortest contracts in sports.
Mm-hmm.
Even NFL players signed.
But they're all guaranteed.
3 years.
They're all guaranteed. But we're going to give you more money early because after 3 years, you can go shop yourself and probably triple your money from years 4 to 6. You're going to lose it on the back end because teams only can sign you for a maximum of 3 years.
Hmm. Are the players really winning with that? I guess they're not. That's the kind of a concession for the owners because they're not getting much of that long-term security. And, you know, I almost feel like from the team standpoint, the fact that you can't lock somebody up for a long-term deal is almost a negative from the team standpoint because – you know, the NBA, I hear it all the time. These guys are switching teams from 1 year to the next, and the stars keep moving, and that's not good.
But you can't leave until after 6 years.
Well, you have player control until, like, they can decide to leave if you don't match the restricted free agents.
Correct. Right? But then that means you don't think they're worth
it. So, yeah, you have player control up to six years. Well, though, baseball right now, you have player control for how many
years?
Yeah, so for six still. So, I think that's a big problem. Do you have any more suggestions that you want to put up before I start
to give my suggestions
feedback on some of them? Pace of play. I'm going to go to the top of your list. And just so you can get a Cliff Notes version if you're just tuning in, what were your pace of play suggestions?
Shorten the breaks. Put the banner at the bottom. Replace the ticker with Budweiser or McDonald's or Wendy's or whatever you want on the bottom of it. And then you can have a read by the announcer coming back or maybe a bumper. This half inning is brought to you by whatever the said sponsor is. You'd shave 15 minutes off a game.
I think pace of play is less of a problem than what is perceived. I don't think the pace of the play is as much – like the length of the game, I should say, is as much of the problem as the action that's taking place within that time period isn't as fun. Like that, I think that's the main problem because college football games are getting longer and longer and longer and extremely long. And outside of a few handful of people who complain about the length of some replays, nobody's talking about altering the length of the game for college football. So I think we should limit some of the dead time. Like there's no need to me for warm-up pitches for bullpen guys after they just spent the last 10 minutes throwing warm-up pitches in the bullpen. If you're throwing warm-up pitches in the bullpen, then you should be ready to come on out and start throwing some strikes. Go out there.
If you got to give somebody a chance to get a feel of the mound. A little bit different.
All right,
sorry.
Two, three. We don't need to take a commercial break and have you come back and then have the whole graphic for your stats. You were out here throwing. Make the mound in the bullpen the same size as the mound out there on the middle of the field. There shouldn't have to be another 90 seconds for pitching change. That's ridiculous to me because you've been spending time warming up. So that's one area where you can do it. And mound visits, I don't think you need as many mound visits as there are. There's an absurd amount of mound visits at times, especially in the playoffs. So those are areas where dead time can be cut. But other than that, I'm kind of with you. You didn't have any drastic, like, you know, put runners at second base. That's not baseball. What was the Rich Eisen rule? I forget, the Rich Eisen had a suggestion recently. That wasn't the second base one.
No, that was in the ninth inning. If you're losing,
you put up whoever you want.
That's not even a pace of play thing. That's just
change the deck.
I like the thinking, though, because you're marketing the individual, which is to another one of your point. And you said you didn't really have ideas of how to promote stars. But I did see today on it kind of blew up on social media a little bit. Like, they were interviewing in a spring training game Mookie Betts while he was out there in right field. And the ball was hit towards him in right field. And he's out here talking to the broadcasters as he's out here chasing the ball that's into the corner. He's like, I'm not going to get this one, boys. And
But it's an exhibition game.
But why not? There's no reason that can't be a real game, especially because baseball has so much of a lack of urgency, which is what I'm going to get to in a second. I want you to address the lack of urgency.
But how would you like your guy to be chatting with Joe Buck and all of a sudden?
Go for it. You know what? Because is it really affecting his job? Is it really limiting him from chasing the ball and throwing it back into the infield? Baseball players are out here chewing sunflower seeds. What other sport are you out there on the court eating? Like, literally. Like, what other sport are you out here eating while you're on the field?
Golf, maybe?
I mean, like, that's what I thought. At golf, you should be able to talk to Tiger Woods as he's walking the course if you really wanted to. So, like, baseball's different. It's not while you're out here trying to defend LeBron James on an island in an ISO. You're in right field. You're at second base. You can do it. You can talk to the broadcasters. So that's just one of the many ways where the individual can become more of the star. And I'm going to maybe like kind of throw problems at you, and some of them are maybe answers that you kind of suggested. But like, I think that baseball has a problem embracing new youth. And I think that they rely too much on their history as their asset, when I do think youth is more of their asset than their history. Because I'm talking to somebody from my generation, we don't care as much about the history of the game as you think we do, as baseball thinks we do. And maybe that's just me, and I think I'm more historically than a lot of people my age do. But I just don't think that people care as much about the past of the game as much as they throw it at us on every commercial break or every All-Star game or, you know, World Series. They just try to splash down black and white images down my face, and every time I see black and white, I'm saying, I'm tuning out. Like, I don't want to see black and white. And baseball throws more black and white at you than any other sport, especially when you have the option to go nuts with youth. And that's what the NFL is doing with the draft and how big of a deal that's been, because you're talking about youth and potential. The NBA rookie race this year with all the guys and how they're promoted and how they're tweeted about, what's put out on social media. I think all that is more of an asset that baseball has, and stop trying to throw out black and white images of Babe Ruth and his chubby self running around.
First of all, baseball is the only sport that anybody really knows what the records are. Now, you and I disagree. I think it's one of the things that makes baseball great, that you can compare more likely one era to the next. But I think one of the problems baseball does have is the draft isn't a big deal. And the reason it isn't a big deal is you're not going to see any of those people play in the big leagues for another 3 or 4 years. Where in football and basketball, they are going to go play immediately in the league, or certainly the top picks in both of those drafts. And they're a lot of times going to be stars. Very rarely, if ever, does somebody go, and I can probably think of two or three people, and not a whole lot of them did it with success, do they go from the draft to playing in baseball. So I think it's a different setup. It's a different setup, and you wonder if the draft would be different if they drafted people in the NBA and all went to the G League to start. It probably would be different.
Now, why is it that we always seem hesitant on actually like crowning people in baseball when they get off to hot starts? Like, Yasiel Puig was met with so much hesitation when he like came onto the scene and started like doing stuff. You know, Bellinger, in a way, like, it took him, like, he had to do it the whole season before people actually started to believe he was good and to actually get the hype around it. So what is it about this game that just anything that's new, it can be maybe a rule, or it could be just a player in itself, that if this were the NFL and a quarterback came in and threw, like, Cam Newton in his first game, he threw, what, 5 touchdowns? That was ridiculous, and we went nuts for it. Rhys Hoskins was barely a mention for Major League Baseball. I know it was later in the season, but like, this dude came up and put up records for home runs within his first, 15 games that we hadn't seen before.
I think baseball is hesitant to anoint people until they've been around the league a couple of times. because I think of all the sports, greater adjustments are made with how you pitch to somebody or how you attack a certain pitcher that a lot of people have come up and look good under a very small sample size. But then when they have to try to stay there for a full season, two seasons, three seasons, four seasons, I think the highs and lows are greater in baseball than some of the other sports. So I think that's why people are hesitant in the first year. And I do think a lot of why people didn't accept Puig was the way he played and how he carried himself on the field. But I think people are hesitant to recognize certain rookies is because a lot of them will come up in the past and have not done well after they had the big flash in the pan start.
A couple more things. Why do you want to shorten the season? You said you wanted to shorten the season, but you didn't really give an explanation.
The reason why I think you want to shorten the season is I don't think you want to have baseball played in very bad weather in the fall. And the weather in the spring is not that good either. So I think you need to get to the postseason, and I did want to extend the wild card for more than one game. So I think in order to do that, you'd have to basically trim about a week to a week and a half off the schedule to be able to do that. All right. I wouldn't if weather was not an issue in the fall or in the early spring in a lot of places, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't short it. I'd leave it at 162. But you got to give something to get something.
Well, we are giving you absolute power, so we can turn you into Mother Nature and you can decide the weather.
I decided that I didn't deserve that as a full. I didn't deserve that.
Now, all right, the last thing, and I know we're kind of close here, but like I think the one of the big problems, not I mean big problems in relation to I guess where baseball used to be, but it's still pretty popular, but I do think there's a lack of urgency at times, especially in regular season baseball. Can get this routine, monotonous. It's just the same thing over and over again. And I've always, you know, brought it up here. The split the season thing is just a way to, you know, in the middle of the season, create almost a pennant race in July, which how great is baseball when it's important? Playoff baseball is awesome because there is that level of urgency. How can you recreate urgency within the game? Maybe you could do something like that. Is there any suggestion that you would have, or do you think that the urgency of the game is something that should be addressed?
I don't want to see halves. I don't want to see a team like Cincinnati and St. Louis in the strike year both get left out with better records than teams that won each half. So I'm sorry. I can't sign off on halves. That would be one of the things that I would be probably behind the runner at second base, but they'd be close to being the no way. So I just don't see it. I think baseball is a marathon, not a sprint, and the teams that deserve to be there in postseason are the teams that do it over the course of the whole year, not for half a season that deserve to be in the playoffs. I don't want to see somebody that got hot in the second half of the season go to the playoffs and win the World Series.
The reason a 100-meter dash gets more TV eyeballs than the marathons.
Oh. Some of us may like the marathon better than the 100-meter dash, but if I'm the commissioner, I'm not changing that. That's one of them that would be non-negotiable. $1,000, that's like 100 six-packs. You're shot at $1,000 four times every weekday, 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. All you have to do is text the keyword to win. Remember, please don't do it while you're driving. 4K a day starts Thursday, 7 a.m., on Sports Radio The Ticket. Up next in the update, what are the latest national coaching dominoes to fall in college basketball? It's coming up on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio The Ticket.
This Ticket Sports Update sponsored by Stormore Sheds. Create a space of your own with a new shed, shop, or garage from Idaho's best-selling shop for over 25 years. See why for yourself at Stormore Sheds in Meridian. Well, a couple notes from Mountain West basketball. Caleb Martin, the Mountain West Player of the Year, was named as an honorable mention to the All-American AP team today. He, of course, was second in the Mountain West with 19.1 points per game. Him and his brother Cody will have 1 year of eligibility left should they not choose to declare. Speaking of declaring, it came out today that Brandon McCoy, UNLV's center freshman, has declared for the NFL draft and, according to 247 Sports, does plan to sign an agent, meaning his college career is effectively over.
I think you probably mean he chose to sign or go into the NBA draft, not
yes,
the NFL,
yes,
although
the
he might be a good tight end. I don't know. But, yeah, I think that he's going with an agent. I think he came to UNLV with the idea that he was going to be one and done. I think we thought that when we saw him playing here. And I have not heard anything of Caleb Martin even mentioning putting his toes in, but I bet he does. And I think much like Chandler Hutchison, I bet he would come back.
I'm just going to throw out a hypothetical. Let's say they both left. Let's say, like, you know, they wanted to start playing professional basketball.
Caleb and
Cody.
Both of them, or are we talking about the guy from UNLV?
Both of them, and you know what? Their dad's now suddenly LeVar Ball. So, like, they're out here just doing the most. Hypothetical, they've gone. Is Nevada still the favorite for the Mountain West the next year. I'm just wondering how important
they lose Stevens and they lose those two?
Yeah.
No, I would think not. Although they've got two or three other sit-outs, transfers, that it'd be interesting to see where the minutes go. They're not from the same high-caliber Power 5-type programs of Purdue and North Carolina State. They're from Bryant and, I don't know, but supposedly pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And with their track record of the few people they brought in as transfers, if they say they're pretty good, I think they're probably pretty good. But, no, I think if you lost two people, you wouldn't just rubber stamp them as the final. I think you'd have to, as the heir apparent to three-peating. But if they only lose Stevens and that's the only guy they lose, you're going to have to show me somebody that's going to take them. I mean, Boise State, who was second, you'd have to say at least with what's back is going to be weaker than they are. You know, you're counting on a lot of people to play different roles. You're returning players. You're counting on some freshmen to come in. But if Nevada returns everybody but Kendall Stevens, they would be clearly the best team in the league again. Now you take two other guys off the team, I think you'd have to look a little bit. I might be leaning to San Diego State, but they lose Kel and they lose Pope. So, you know, there's a lot being lost by some of the other better teams in the conference. Boise State, second overall. San Diego State, the team that won the tournament. Both are going to lose top shelf players.
Second hypothetical for you, based on Nevada basketball. Let's say that the Martins come back, but there's an NBA team that wants to give Eric Musselman another chance in the NBA, and Eric Musselman leaves, and they have to promote an assistant to being their head coach. Are you still likely to pick them to be first in the Mountain West? Again, the Martins stay in this hypothetical, but the guy who leaves is Musselman.
I think you'd pick him first, but I think that that'd be a tough spot for somebody to come in and try to take over and learn on the job training. I think that would be a big miss for Nevada if something like that were to happen. The job now that's open is Xavier. I don't think he'd be the kind of guy, not East guy, at least hasn't been, at least in college. Two pro teams were out West. I would think they'd look in a different direction than Eric Musselman, but right now with most of the jobs on the West Coast not being of the high-level jobs, I don't know. I would think that would be a major hit if Musselman left.
Yeah, I mean, the Clippers, for example, could have an opening if Doc Rivers wants to take a different job, which is always rumored. So, you know, he's a West Coast guy, and he's been an NBA head coach before in the state of California.
Yeah, trying to go for every team in the league in the state of California. You'd have the Kings and the Warriors. And then if he got the Clippers, then he'd only need the Lakers to create the all four teams in the state of California. I don't know. I mean, he's won in college. But is there anything in his two stops at Golden State and Sacramento that would lead you to think maybe?
I don't think he got a fair shake in Sacramento. Okay. A lot of the coaches there didn't get really a fair shake. Their ownership situation was awful. So.
And still is, probably.
Yeah, I'm not going to really hold that against him. Although, shout out Vivek Ranadive for his comments. I guess it was over the weekend with all that's going on in that Sacramento area. And with the Warriors, yeah, I don't think many people deem that as him doing a great job there, but I wouldn't be shocked if at some point down the line he gets another NBA gig. It seems like he's, you know, getting a lot of attention out there with all his shirt off and out here running around like a chicken with his head cut off. His family out here now famous.
Well, speaking of basketball jobs, a couple of them filled today in college basketball. University of Pittsburgh has hired Duke assistant Jeff Cable to be their head coach coming off a winless year in the ACC for Pittsburgh. And it came out today, reported by Jeff Goodman of ESPN, that Xavier head coach Chris Mack has left that job. He will be taking the head coaching job at Louisville. 7 years, $4 million a year on that contract.
I wonder what would make Jeff Cable more desirable than what he did at Oklahoma. I mean, he goes back and you're an assistant at Duke. I don't know. I just find that sometimes when you hire somebody, not to say you don't want to give somebody a second or a third chance, but it just, to me, was an interesting pick. When I was thinking in my mind where Pitt might go for a head coach, I never considered Jeff Capel at Duke.
Yeah, I mean, he got the Griffins when he was at Oklahoma, and they beat Syracuse, I think, in the NCAA tournament, so I wasn't happy about that. So it's just my favorite memory of Oklahoma and Jeff Capel. And, you know, Griffins, I think he had, like, a connection with them going a while back, so it almost, like, made a lot of sense that they went there, and they brought them to pretty good heights. Well, when Blake Griffin, was the other one, Ryan? I forget the other guy's name, but he was also a good player for that Oklahoma squad.
Good college player, yeah. Not a pro. And I'm surprised, Fish, that you didn't have the other coaching hire. The High Point team, small Division One, is going to be taking Tubby Smith, who is a High Point alum. And so Tubby will coach another team. That's kind of a quick exit from Memphis. Kind of get stabbed in the back by Penny Hardaway there. And then, you know, 65, 66 years old, is going to go back to some of the smallest places in D1.
I mean, I don't think he got a fair shake in Memphis. Like, what are you going to do in 2 years? Like, that's not a program that was in a position of strength when he took it over. So there wasn't much he was going to do in 2 years there. And was there something to be said for holding out and waiting for another opening? You can maybe get that, or is Tubby Smith's reputation so far down now that he can't just wait and pick a job down the line? He needs to coach a team like High Point to prove himself.
Yeah, or maybe he just flat out wants to coach, wants to have a team, can't see himself, you know, going a season without coaching. I mean, he's gone from Tulsa to Georgia. You know, that was a step up. Georgia to Kentucky, a definite step up. Was never appreciated at Kentucky as well as he should have been. They ended up going to Minnesota and then to Texas Tech and then jumped to Memphis. So he's kind of bounced around, you know, in the latter part of his career. It will be interesting to see what he does at High Point. I do know some coaches that have gone down to a much smaller place with a much, much smaller budget, that can be the most difficult thing. You're going to be on buses a lot.
I mean, take a look at, like, coaches that won championships. There isn't many that, like, got less out of it in terms of credit and or, like, future success or future opportunities than Tubby Smith. Like, I have the list open, and I think the only other guy who's even close to being cast aside in the way that is Kevin Ollie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of recent, like, I want to go down the list. Roy Williams, Jay Wright, Coach K, Kevin Ollie, Rick Pitino, Calipari, Calhoun, K, Williams, Self, Donovan, again, Williams again, Calhoun again, Boeheim, Williams, K, Izzo, Calhoun, Smith. That's all the way back in 1998. Olson, Pitino, Herrick for UCLA back in 1995. Nolan Richardson in 94. So you're now talking in my lifetime of watching basketball. All these other guys are lionized once they win a championship, except Kevin Ollie and Tubby Smith. And then what do they have in common?
I think I'd put Herrick on the list of.
Okay, well, I'll say since him, because I didn't see Herrick. That's 1995. I was 4 years old.
Okay,
I'm going to go since I've been watching college basketball. The only two that have won titles that have been black are the ones who have been cast aside like they're nothing. After
well,
winning
but also that, and that may be true, but they are very different in how that they have done it. Smith has bounced around. Ollie has been unceremoniously fired on the job that he won the championship. Now, Smith was pushed aside. I guess technically not fired, but they made it very difficult for him to want to stay at Kentucky. But, you know, Connecticut, I think it's going to be fascinating, is trying to prove that they can fire Ollie with cause so they don't have to pay him. I think that's going to be a very, very tough proof for the University of Connecticut. I think they'd be better off just scratching out the check to Ollie. I think the legal fees will be very high. But you're right, those two guys, based on the way they are looked at post-championship, you know, right now they're also very different in that Smith is mid-60s and Ollie's what, mid-30s? Late 30s?
He is 45.
Okay, 45. I was thinking about when he kind of got hired. So. But certainly on the younger side of coaching, more coaches are probably older than 45 than under 45 that are coaching. Final Four coming on Saturday to Sports Radio The Ticket. The incredible Loyola of Chicago story will continue at 4 as the Ramblers will meet Michigan, and it'll be followed by Kansas and Villanova. That's from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. Final Four on Sports Radio The Ticket. National championship game will be Monday at 7:20. If you can't watch, be sure to listen to The Ticket. Up next, what did we learn in today's show? Plenty of things discussed between basketball and baseball. We'll also take a peek into what's coming up on Caves and Prater that you won't want to miss either. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
It's time to find out what we learned on Idaho Sports Talk today with Bob and Chris. It's brought to you by Prime Sports, your full-service pro shop bowling specialist, high-quality bowling balls, bags, and accessories located right inside West East Garden Lanes in Garden City. Opening day in baseball is just 2 days away. So, of course, Chris and I decided we need to give Bob unlimited full power of baseball. We have made him commissioner for the day. So, Bob, why don't you give us the Cliff Notes version of what's changing under Bob Beeler's new regime in Major League Baseball?
I think I made everybody mad, every constituency mad, maybe with the exception of the umpires. They might like what I had in here. All right. Pace of play. Don't screw with the actual game itself. Try to tighten things up between innings. Want to change replay to no New York. I want to have a fifth umpire that travels with the crew that rotates from the field to upstairs. They make the call in the press box. I want to expand the rosters, limit the number of pitchers on a roster. So obviously you don't have as many people that you can, you know, it's capped. You can't go to 28 players and have 15, 16 pitchers. I want to make the game more fun. I want to change the economics of the game where local TV is divided up a little more evenly than it is now. And I want to give more money to the players in the first 6 years and less money to players that are older that don't deserve it.
So it's a big summary of changes. I just think the urgency thing is the only – baseball's still really popular. The playoff numbers are still fantastic. This past postseason was great. I think juice balls had a lot to do with it, and you didn't mention anything about whether you want to keep the baseballs juiced or not.
I don't make the balls. Those balls are fine.
Well, you don't think Commissioner Manfred had a little bit of something to say about the fact that all of a sudden these players are hitting more home runs than ever and – people are claiming the baseballs are juiced and the pitchers are complaining that the baseballs are different, that the commissioner has no influence. No influence.
It sounds like from what people say that feel the balls and pitch them feel that they feel different.
So you're the commissioner here. You could go back to the old baseball of what it used to be, or you can keep with this new one that seems to be flying out the ballpark more.
Fans like it. I'll keep the new ball.
There you go.
JP in studio getting set to, I don't know what I was going to say, corral Caves and Prater, get them in here in our seats to get them going here at 3 o'clock. They've got a good start with Leon Rice.
Yeah, we've got Coach Leon Rice. He's had a couple of weeks to kind of decompress after the season. We're going to talk to him about the season. We've got, of course, the Final Four coming up. He's played against one of those teams in that Final Four. Also going to kind of talk about, you know, some of the hardest positions in sports to play. Goalie. One of those being one of those, and we've got the Steelhead's newest goalie. He's been with the team for just a short time. He's got him on a 5-game win streak, so Thomas Scholl going to join us at 4 o'clock as well.
That's interesting. Off the top of my head, any baseball position
I would think catcher would be among those.
Yeah, because like a catcher especially, because you have to know the pitching, you have to know, you have to be in a crouch all day, which I can't imagine is easy. And the skill of hitting a baseball is still ridiculous. Like if you
let's
think
just
about
say
it.
Middle reliever would not be one of the toughest.
I want to be a left-handed
middle reliever.
Six pitches, you know, at the end of a game. No, that's not tough.
I think catcher probably would be one. I mean, I would think that if you look at pressure and all the things you deliver, quarterback would have to be there, right?
Yeah, I would think so. Now, as part of it, like the reward, like goalie gets a lot of the love, not like quarterback. Like quarterback, like are we counting just difficult to do at itself, or like difficult as in like you don't get much love, but it's still a necessary job?
I think the quarterback gets love, so I think if that's the case, boot that out. How many times in postseason have you seen teams in the NHL go on a run because their goalie all of a sudden plays out of his mind?
That seems like it happens every year. It seems like you ride the hot goaltender. That's the cliche. And you know, you score a couple of goals every now and then, and all of a sudden you're out here competing for the Stanley Cup championship. You could be an 8 seed or a 7th seed, and that can happen. You could be a 1 or 2 seed. And that's part of, like, we're talking about how the NCAA tournament is so random. And you know, it might be appealing because it's random. I think right behind it is the NHL postseason in terms of, hey, 8 seed has just as much of a chance in a way as the 1 seed.
The NHL, yeah. I think is the greatest chance for a bad seed to win. I think if you told me an 8 seed is going to win, I think I'd go hockey first. I think I'd go baseball second.
And they don't even have 8 seeds.
Well, or whatever the lowest seed, wild card. And then I think I'd put NBA last.
Yeah.
NBA would be last. We'll be back tomorrow. Keep it tuned. Coach Leon Rice with Caves and Prater coming up in just a matter of minutes. Back with more on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.